Hello and welcome to the Institute of Leadership and Management's weekly podcast, where we discuss some topical leadership issues. This week, we're focusing on events up until the 25th of January 2019. My name's Nick Scott, and I'm an economist and academic working with the Institute of Leadership and Management, and as usual, I'm joined today by Kate Cooper, the Institute's Head of Research, Policy and Standards. Hello, Kate.
Hello, Nick.
The notion of a four-day working week recently resurfaced when the biomedical research charity, the Wellcome Trust, announced that it was one of a number of options they had under serious review, with a potential trial in the autumn. Chief of Staff Ed Whiting told the Guardian newspaper that existing research suggests that a shorter working week can deliver both significant employee well-being benefits and the potential for greater productivity, with the healthier and happier workforce both using their time at work more effectively and taking less time off work. Kate, do you agree that the benefits could offset these missing hours?
Certainly seems to be the case as happened in New Zealand, and the experience was properly analysed by leadership experts from academic communities, and they reported improved or reduced levels of absenteeism and sickness absence, higher morale, and absolutely no loss, in fact, an increase in productivity. So the evidence immediately seems compelling and persuasive. If we can achieve more in 4 days than we're managing to achieve in five, why are we working for five?
Well, the take-up of a four-day working week is currently very limited, and the Wellcome Foundation would be the biggest organisation to date to adopt this strategy. Might it need more and larger organisations to go down this road before it's seen as either viable or legitimate?
I think the Wellcome Foundation are in a relatively privileged position, being a head office, not having customer-facing services to provide, not having expectations that they will provide their services or products on a 24/7 basis, and they can shut down. Now, that immediately raises questions about empty and unused space for now 3 days a week rather than the more traditional two. And it's not a pattern that can be repeated if you are indeed providing those customer-facing services that require people to be there at certain times. But a four-day week doesn't have to be the whole organisation only operating for 4 days. It can mean, of course, that certain employees work for 4 days, and that is the expectation of them. And I think that is something where you could see can be transferred from organisation to organisation with the ensuing benefits that have been evidenced in New Zealand.
A recent report by the joint CIPD and UK government initiative, the Flexible Working Task Force, warns that the number of employees using flexible working patterns has flatlined since 2010, despite the right to request part-time work or compressed hours or job sharing being extended to all workers in 2014. Why do you think the take-up has been so limited?
It's very interesting because the evidence for the benefits of flexible working, the levels of appreciation that are shown by people who do work flexibly, seems very, very persuasive. So one can't really explain why it's not being taken up. Similarly, very, very strong business cases are put forward for flexible working. And I think ultimately, if there's a strong business case, we really have to ask ourselves, why isn't this happening? So who's stopping it happening? It's not systems, policies and processes that's stopping this take up. It therefore must be managers. Everyone now has the right to request flexible working, and maybe many of those requests are being turned down. So why do not the managers of people who want to work flexibly want them to do that? And I think, as Peter Cheese says in this report, there's something about it requiring a different style of management, a different sort of approach. And we know how difficult leadership and management is, how there are reported gaps in this area. And this is really a very different, a whole new way of leading and managing. Perhaps there lies the resistance to it.
This report suggests that job roles should be advertised as flexible by default, Do you think that's a viable option?
In terms of what we're hearing from everybody about productivity, about closing gender pay gaps, about widening our talent pools, about being able to reward people in non-financial ways, I cannot understand why every organisation doesn't start from the position that this job should be flexible, give me reasons why it shouldn't be. Because we know, as I said earlier, that it's a very attractive and compelling offer for so many people. So my answer to that, yes, absolutely. Advertise jobs as flexible and see the benefits in terms of the widening of the talent pool that that can bring. And then evaluate as to how successful or otherwise it's been, rather than finding excuses in the first place not to do it by saying, well, we're different, our company, our organisation, our sector, our industry, all of the reasons why we can't offer flexible working.
In our final story this week, the Financial Times reports on an innovative global alliance between car giants Ford and Volkswagen. In the near future, they will work collaboratively on new developments such as driverless technology and electric vehicles. Unlike the previous big alliance between Renault and Nissan, which resulted in a degree of financial merger through each acquiring stock in the other, the innovative element of this proposed partnership is that it's a collaboration which involves no swap of equity. The media are calling this a non-merger. Why do you think this type of arrangement might be attractive?
This is great evidence of how important it is to collaborate and how one can collaborate without changing organisation structures, without the need for rebranding, without the need for all of those expensive costs associated with mergers or acquisitions. We can share the results of this collaboration, or the results in this instance can be shared. The benefits both parties can obtain from them, and they don't actually have to change the way they operate, the markets that they're in, or have that huge disruption that we know often does not deliver the benefits that are promised.
Well, we do know that some mergers are much more successful than others. Why do you think that's the case?
The evidence for this is so mixed and so complicated because frequently, for example, cultural integration is cited as one of the critical success factors. How you get two very disparate organisations operating in different ways, and we know that culture is unspoken, it's the way we do things, it's implicit, it emerges over time. How can you easily get one culture and fit it in with another? Obviously, this is done successfully at times, but very difficult to replicate. I think, again, if there's a real enthusiasm for a merger or an acquisition, there will be an optimism that's built in to the projections that are not realised because, of course, factors change once the thing is implemented. And I think what we often underestimate, and it does have a genuine financial impact, is resistance to change. So if you want people to merge into a new organisation and pull together, we know there is going to be resistance to that. But of course, once the excitement of the rebranding and the news stories are over, there's often underinvestment in making it work, keeping the momentum going and making people feel part of something new.
Well, thanks very much for that, Kate. Unfortunately, that's all we've got time for this week. Please go to the website www.institutelm.com to find out more about the Institute of Leadership and Management. And please subscribe to this podcast series.